Portland or Southern Maine, wherever you're listening. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. It's Saturday, November 30th. How are we doing today, Deb?
Pretty good. How are you?
We're taping this early in the week, but it'll air on Saturday, so we have to kind of, I'll ask, hey, how was your Thanksgiving, knowing that it's 2 days from now?
It was fantastic, is what I will say.
God, okay. Well, I'm anticipating a fantastic Thanksgiving, too.
Good for you.
Everyone kind of does. Do you do turkey? Does anyone not do
turkey? You know what? We normally do, but this year it's just my husband and I, and he would like to do a ham. So we're doing ham on Thanksgiving.
Wow. Yeah. My guess is there's some pretty good bargains on ham out there. Yeah, the turkey market is a little bit tough, but that's smart. That's smart. Go against the grain.
There you go.
Right? You go right up against the grain. So that's fantastic. Today's show, which we have two very, very interesting guests. These are both guests that we had interviewed a few days ago, and so it's pre-recorded. Mm-hmm. But later on this hour, we have Dr. Bernard Laune.
Yep.
And what an unbelievable interview.
Great interview.
Dr. Laune is the developer of the defibrillator, or at least the DC power version as opposed to AC, and he explains what that means. He's also a Nobel Peace Prize winner and a Gandhi Peace Prize winner, and he's just done some incredible things, and 91 years old.
Yeah, he is.
And he's still quick and nimble, and he corrected me on some things
he
and
did,
yelled at me a couple times. Yeah. And
but he was impressed with you, too.
Oh, I think it was an impressive discussion, and I think he was clearly the smartest guy in the room during that interview, but I've got a feeling I could probably outrun him in a foot race.
Yes.
I don't think he'd really care about that. And then in the second hour, we have Mark Swan. Really interesting guy. He does some really incredible work with Preble Street, and we'll be talking about what's going on in Portland in terms of their work. And then some broader issues and safety net issues and social service programs here in Maine and around the country and policy issues. Mm-hmm. So I think those are important discussions. But let's get right to on this day, November 30th, mm-hmm. 1982, Michael Jackson's Thriller.
One of the great ones.
Yeah, do you remember this video?
I do.
Who was it? God, I can't remember. The album was produced by Quincy Jones, but there was a famous director who did a lot of movies, and he did the... Because the video Thriller was like its own little movie.
It was, yep.
Thriller enabled. Yeah, Michael Jackson, he's still... It feels like he and his family just never leave the news, right?
Yeah.
Even whether it was in life or death, it's always controversial. There's always something going on.
Yeah.
And they're still going through lawsuits and wrongful death, and his doctor was just put in jail. The guy gave him the propofol or whatever the sedative was, and brothers are fighting brothers. And
that's too bad.
And the kids, the two daughters, there was Paris, the little boy, and then the girl is going through something. What's her name, the little girl?
Blanket is the boy.
I don't know if that's good intel. We'll have to double check that. Shani says Blanket is the name of the boy. Well, I know there's Paris, and then I know that.
Blanket. Excuse me, I'll cut this.
Yeah,
crazy.
I know that's what Shani says. Blanket, and my guess is maybe there's another kid named Pillow, and I don't know. But there's just so much drama, right?
Oh, I know.
The parents, the father, who is just famously so tough on the whole Jackson 5. And
is he still around?
He's still around, and the mother had custody. Shani, do you have an update on the name?
There's Paris is the daughter.
Paris?
Prince is one of the sons.
Prince, that's one I was talking
about. That's right.
Michael Joseph Jackson Jr., that's who they call Blank.
Right, so it's his name, Michael Jr. He's not really called Blanket.
Jackson Jr.
Yeah. Bad intel from Shani.
Okay.
Okay, it was a nickname. That doesn't count. But Michael Jackson, he's just so talented, but so troubled. And that really follows the trend in terms of artists for thousands of years, right? The great artists are all, you know, a little
issues.
A little twisted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe there's something that goes, there's a correlation between genius and kind of the wackiness that goes with
maybe
that.
Maybe it's good to be mediocre.
Well, is that
or not?
Is that the position you want to hold? Is that you want to claim that? I'm not going to. That's not me to judge. I don't think of you as mediocre.
Oh, thank you. Hopefully, higher than mediocre, right?
Of course, of course. I think you're exceptional.
Thank you, Steve. Likewise.
What else do we have on this day? 1993, President Bill Clinton signed into the Brady Bill. God, that's still...
Is that even effective?
The Brady Bill?
Yeah.
Well, it was named after James Brady, who I think was the press secretary. He worked with President Ronald Reagan, and he was shot by John Hinckley.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's effective in that it created a five-day waiting period for handguns and background checks for certain, but it also instituted federal background checks. But there's still so many loopholes.
Yeah, that's why I don't think it's very effective.
You and I probably differ on the whole gun thing, pretty much like everything else, right?
Probably, yeah.
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 I think my feeling is that I certainly believe in the Second Amendment, certainly believe in, you know, the right to bear arms and all that. I just think we need to have reasonable laws that for the greater good. And we have more and more instances of mental illness in the country. There's more and more pressures and involving veterans coming back from war and people suffering mental illness for many, many reasons. And I just think there should be a reasonable waiting period. I think there should be a database and maybe training. You know, if you're going to buy a gun, you know, if you're going to buy contact lenses, you have to go and get, you know, go to an eye doctor and get kind of trained. You can't just go into a drugstore and say, give me some contact lenses.
Hmm.
I don't know. You have a view on this you want to share?
I see what you're saying, but I see it as more of a mental health problem as than a gun problem. I believe in the Second Amendment, period. That's it. Now, I just think that with the good, you take the bad.
So the guys who periodically walk around the Back Bay of the Cove down in Portland, the guys who over the last few years have done it a couple times, they dress up in camo, and they have some sort of AK gun with a 30-round clip. They sling it over their shoulders, and while parents and kids are walking around on a sunny little walk, you know, these knuckleheads walk around with what look like semi or assault rifles or semi-assault rifles.
Is there a law against that?
No. In fact, there's a law that protects it, and that's the problem.
Why? Why is that a problem, though? I don't understand. Why?
Why?
I don't think you can say, I agree with the Second Amendment, but I don't want anybody walking around with a gun.
But the Second Amendment doesn't talk about that. The Second Amendment doesn't say that you can't own a tank or a nuclear weapon, but we figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, we can't afford it, nor most of us.
And you think that's the barrier? If you could afford a hand grenade, you should be able to buy hand grenades? Why not?
Well, I don't think a hand grenade is out of our pocket, but a tank would be.
What about a bazooka? Should you be able to buy a bazooka?
I think you should be able to buy whatever you can afford and want, yeah.
You think that's the measure?
There are no restrictions on the Second Amendment.
I know, but when things were written 200 years ago, nobody anticipated either
that people would walk around with guns?
Well, no, that people would walk, you know, they were muskets. It was like, you know, you'd shoot every 30 seconds. Nobody anticipated modern weapons, and nobody anticipated, you know, if there's a major event, if there's, what's the big, the Old Port Festival.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a person with a machine gun or a semi-assault rifle should be able to just walk through the Old Port Festival. I don't think it's responsible. I don't think
I don't know? I think that comes from a position of fear. myself. I mean, if we, there are many people, especially in this state, who teach their children how to handle a weapon at what, 10?
But at the Old Port Festival, you should bring a loaded gun with 30 bullets.
I don't think you should. No, but there's no law against it.
But should we have a law against it?
No. I don't think we should restrict our right to keep and bear arms.
What is so sacred, do you think, about that right versus other rights, versus people's rights to be able to go to a festival or go to the Cumberland County Fair and have cotton candy without seeing five guys in camo gear with assault weapons walking through? Do you think that's disruptive?
I'm not scarred by that. I'm not scarred by seeing men walking by with guns.
We're not talking about, first of all, we're not talking about guys heading out to go hunting.
Right.
We're talking in this kind of example, a number of people, one, two, three, four, walking with semi-automatic, automatic-looking weapons in a public place.
Right.
That,
and if they don't fire the weapon, then they're not doing any harm.
But how can you say they're not doing, in a practical sense, if you saw that, you don't think that would cause harm? You don't think that hundreds of people. You don't think hundreds of people would run out of the way. You think everyone would be like, "Oh yeah, look at that! There's some guys with machines." With all the stuff happening and all the killings that have taken place over the last 5 years, all the mass murder, whether it's Sandy Hook or anywhere, or the movie theater in Colorado, with all that, do you really think that it means nothing to have a group of guys walking with semi-automatic weapons in a public kind of communal event?
Well, you bring up a good point. The day and age in which we live is obviously going to make us wonder. But if you just ask the question, does it cause any harm for anybody to walk down the street with a gun if it's legal, then I have to say then they have every right to do so. I think that sometimes we all expect to live in a world where we're not we don't encounter fear, we don't encounter issues, and I just don't think that's realistic. If we have the right to walk down the street with a gun, then everybody should know that, and if we see it, then, yeah, you know what? I'm going to get out of the way. I might not run and panic, but I'm going to walk the other way. I'm going to go down the
Why?
Street. Because in this day and age, you really don't know, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But as long as that law still exists.
The whole argument is we need to change the law.
No, because that takes away my right to protect myself and my family. And I do think that that is one big reason why we have never been attacked as a country on our soil and been defeated. Because you never know who's got a gun.
So you believe, just to be clear, we're not talking about individual kind of home protection, but you believe the United States hasn't been attacked by a foreign force on our soil because of the accessibility and proliferation of guns across America.
I do. I think that's been a big factor.
And if in the last 20 years all those guns disappeared, who would attack us?
And
who knows? We have the biggest military in the world. We have the greatest technology. Do you think Canada is just a little bit scared of taking over America?
In the last 20 years, we've seen Al-Qaeda come to light. We've got third world people all over the place. There are lots of people in the last 20 years that would have liked to see us go. Look at Iran.
We probably differ. I think all it takes is an aircraft carrier and kind of an Air Force wing and Sidewinder missiles and tanks and the biggest military force in the world. You know, the U.S. has a military force equal to the next 10 countries combined.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what creates the deterrent, not the fact that you have a gun on your night table. I don't think anywhere that shows up. That's not to say that people shouldn't have the right to have their own protection, but we're talking about something different. All the discussion that I've heard in the last year or two is 30-round clips. There's nothing either that addresses it or doesn't address it in the Second Amendment, and doing reasonable background checks. Nobody stops your right to have a gun.
I agree.
You know, you have to have a background check before.
I agree,
you have to pass a test to drive a car. You have to pass a test to get glasses, to get contact lenses, to get prescriptions. You've got to go through steps.
Yeah.
Guns should be at least respected to the same level.
I agree with that. And wasn't that what the Brady Bill was supposed to do? And that's why I asked if it was effective, because I don't think it did. I don't think it's being enforced. On the background check stuff.
So, we need more enforcement.
Yeah, well, we need a lot more of everything, but we disagree as usual, Steve. That's
very unusual. Nothing different about it. I thought maybe holiday week could be a little more agreeable. I guess not. What else we have going on here? We've got birthdays. Bo Jackson. Do you remember Bo Jackson?
I honestly do not remember Bo Jackson.
Really?
I seriously don't. No.
Wow.
No, but I've got a little
little thing.
You don't know Diddley.
Yeah, you don't know Diddley.
Bo was incredible. Played baseball and football. I think he graduated from Auburn.
Really?
But he was so quick. He was unbelievably quick. He was unbelievably athletic.
Is he still with us?
I believe so. I think he had knee problems and he had something, but he was one of the first big Nike athletes to be kind of promoted and go beyond just sport in terms of modern day kind of pop culture. So Bo turns 51 today. Shane Victorino with the Red Sox.
Love his name.
Yeah, the Flying Hawaiian. Mm-hmm. He turns 33 today. Feels like the Red Sox, it's only like 3 months till they report for spring training.
I know.
In baseball, the season's so long. It's 162 games in the regular season.
I know.
They play for about a month before, and if they're in the postseason, they play for 6 or 7 weeks after.
I know.
It's crazy how long that's the mood of the sport. It's very long. The games are long.
Yeah.
The practices, it's very leisurely and long.
Yeah.
So he turns 33. Dick Clark, who passed away a year ago, his birthday would be today. He was born in 1929.
Yep.
Ben Stiller. Comedian, actor, director, voice actor, Ben Stiller, he turns 48.
Mm-hmm.
Best, what was the movie with the little, Meet the Parents?
Funny.
Meet the Parents, too.
Very funny.
Very, very funny. So we have Dr. Bernard Lown, fascinating guest. And then in the second hour, at just after noon, 12:06, we've got Mark Swan. I think he goes by the nickname Swanee.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an exciting show.
Yes, we do.
This is Thanksgiving week. It is Saturday, November 30th. As always, really appreciate everyone listening in. In addition to this broadcast, you can go to TideSmartRadio.com to listen to past shows. Or go to iTunes and download this show podcast. Just type in Tide Smart. We're on there. So if you're jogging or working out or you're just traveling and you want to have it on your iPhone or iPod, good way to listen to it, right, Deb?
You bet.
So I hope everyone's enjoying a great vacation week. Thank you for listening. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned for more of Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB.
Your life is on your computer. Family photos, music collections, email. What if a hard drive crash or virus wiped out those files tomorrow? That's why you need Carbonite Online Backup today. Carbonite backs up your computer files automatically. They're kept safely off-site, and it's easy to get them back. Carbonite gives you unlimited backup for only $59 a year. Try it free at Carbonite.com. No credit card required. Use offer code LIFE and get 2 bonus months with purchase. That's Carbonite.com. Offer code LIFE.
I
Welcome back to Todd Smart Talk with Steve-O. This is News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. One of my favorite songs of all time, Heart and Soul. And that ties into our first guest. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Bernard Lowne. And Dr. Lowne is world famous for his work in developing the defibrillator, and also a Nobel Peace Prize winner, and also one of our proud graduates from University of Maine. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
It's good to be back in Maine.
Well, you are verbally throughout Maine today, so it's great to have you back. You're living down outside of Boston, I understand now, in Newton, Mass., which is right next to Needham, where I grew up, so I have a connection to both places.
So we have a neighborly air to begin with.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I'd like to start briefly in terms of your career and the development of the defibrillator has been life-changing all around the globe. But if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about coming here from Lithuania, being an immigrant at age 13, and then how you ended up going to the University of Maine, and then after that we'll talk about some of your other work.
Good. Well, actually, Hitler and the rising tide of anti-Semitism brought my family to the United States. My father had family in Boston who had migrated around 110 years ago to America in 1903.
Wow.
His family was in the shoe business, and unionization of shoe workers in Lynn, where they were first located, pushed the shoe business north to Maine, to Auburn, Bangor, and Pittsfield. The Lowne Shoe in Lewiston was the largest of these factories. I'm really deeply connected with the state of Maine and regard it as my home. As a Lewiston High graduate, we summered on Lake Sebago for close to 70 years. As you mentioned, I have had honorary degrees from five main colleges, the Bernard Lowne Peace Bridge between Lewis and Auburn, across the Androscoggin River, friends all over the state. These are more meaningful to me than the Nobel Prize.
Talk a little bit about that, because you're known because of the iconic nature of the defibrillator, and I want to talk about how that was developed and your role in that. But you're also known for your work involved with peace activities, and I believe you co-founded with Dr. Chazov from Soviet Union, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. So you've been very involved with peace activities as well as your work involving the development and the invention of the defibrillator.
Steve-O, you have done a lot of good research.
Well, you are one of Maine's finest citizens and graduates, and so it's such an honor to have you on the radio show, sir.
Well, it's a privilege to be talking to you and to your audience. The defibrillator actually has a very long history. In a way, it began with antiquity. People were struck by lightning. That is electricity, and when they are struck, they died. Sometimes in the 1745 or thereabouts, the Leyden jar was discovered. This was a device that could be charged with static electricity and deliver a strong electric shock. Some 20 years later, Benjamin Franklin got shocked with his kite experiments. And what is to me incredible is that a Danish veterinarian named Abildgaard shocked chickens insensate and then revived them by shocking them across the chest. Sometimes this occurred sometimes 30 years after Ben Franklin. The modern era begins really with electrification of the United States. In the late 19th century, when we were electrifying America, nearly 1,000 or more linesmen were electrocuted annually. In 1926, Consolidated Edison of New York, in collaboration with the Rockefeller Institute, financed research of defibrillators. Many outstanding names, some of them will be known to your audience, certainly the physicians and health workers, Hoovenhoven, Wiggers, Claude Beck, a thoracic surgeon in Cleveland, who was one of the giant pioneers. And the first thing that was popularized by Paul Zoll here in Boston at the Beth Israel was alternating current. Now, the treatment before the defibrillator was primarily, my preoccupation was with sudden cardiac death that took a toll greater than cancer, about one American dying every 90 seconds. And the defibrillator seemed logical, but I soon realized that the alternating current was very dangerous, was injurious, and killed people, actually. So I began intensive work at Harvard to try to develop an alternative.
We have Dr. Bernard Laun. He is the founder and chairman of the Laun Institute, which you can learn about if you go to www.launinstitute.org. He's also the person who's in 1961 developed the DC defibrillator and also is a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, 20 honorary degrees, and graduated University of Maine summa cum laude. I would love if you talked a little bit about the development and the technology of the defibrillator, and then also that'll lead us into the what started out as a medical device that was really limited, I think, to hospitals and medical centers, and now it has evolved to the point where when you go to many public places, you see the automated external defibrillator, and then we'll talk a little bit about that. But please do, Doctor, talk a little bit about how it was developed and what's the medical use and application to how defibrillators work.
Well, when the heart is hit, let's say by lightning, or the electrical linesman got electrocuted, what happens? The heart's electrical activity becomes disorganized, and when you look at it, it looks like a can of sort of writhing worms instead of a synchronized activity, which is so brilliantly devised, the heart, I wonder, and I wonder, and I wonder. The fact that there is a pacemaker in the heart called the sinus node, and this is a little tiny device that generates an impulse during a lifetime, millions and millions of them, as regular as the best Swiss watch, clock-like. When an electrical discharge from outside, like an alternating current, like you're touching an electric outlet, it disorganizes that beat, and the heart begins to wriggle in many ways. And the electrical activity ceasing, I mean, being overactive, the heart cannot contract and stand still. So you are still alive, in fact, but you're already dying. So there's a brief moment of grace. Now, understanding that issue and being preoccupied with the fact of that there was an American dying every 90 seconds, I began work in the laboratory of the Harvard School of Public Health on how to improve the electrical device, to develop a new waveform that would not cause injury to the heart, that it would defibrillate consistently, and that would be easy to use, would be portable, and all these virtues. And we succeeded. And this is designated at the time as the Laun waveform. It's a single heavily dense sinusoidal wave with very brief duration, only 5 milliseconds. Now, that is the device. Now it became the automated external defibrillator. Most people have heard of as the AED, the automated external defibrillator. And I have some contrarian views, Steve-O. I don't know if you want me to talk about those.
I think so, too. But just to, you know, to, you talked about AC current being alternating current. And when you look at an oscilloscope or you look at the output, it literally AC alternates where it goes up and down. And DC is for direct current, which is a more stable wavelength. And so that was really, I think, as you just mentioned, the basis for your breakthrough in the early 60s is identifying DC current as being the right method to kind of harness electricity to use in a defibrillator. And now as we talk about AEDs, which most people see in public spaces, you see in airports, you see in many large office buildings, the idea was to take the technology out of a controlled medical environment and put it in places where consumers and potentially lay people would have access. And I believe the thinking was when a person is suffering some sort of cardiac event, the whole issue becomes timing, and the quicker somebody can either do CPR or possibly use an AED, the better the survival rate is. But I'd love to hear your thought, Doctor. By the way, we have Dr. Lone, who's on the phone. 1961, he developed the what we know now as the defibrillator, which people see in real life every day, but in movies and in TV shows, it's the two paddles where a conductor, a gel, is put on somebody's chest. The person says clear and usually uses the paddles. And it's revolutionized, and I can't even calculate how many thousands and millions of lives that invention and that creation has saved here in the U.S. and around the world. And Dr. Lown is also a proud graduate of UMaine, where he graduated summa cum laude, also a Nobel Peace Prize winner and 20 honorary degrees. But yes, sir, if you could talk a little bit about the AED and your mixed feelings about that as the inventor of the original defibrillator, I think that'd be fascinating.
Well, I hope I won't be stoned or driven out on a railway tracks from my home state or from Massachusetts. The value, I think, of the AED, or the automated defibrillator, is at airports and baseball games where large crowds assemble. Because the incidence of ventricular fibrillation is very, very small in any population. If you get to put it in everywhere, the cost-benefit is vastly skewed against schools, against kindergartens, against clean water, against having a police department, firemen, on and on. It makes a democratic society, all of these things makes a democratic society worth living. Those are traded for putting defibrillators everywhere where the risk-benefit is so small. Now, it becomes insane when you put in an AED or automated external defibrillator in a home. Try to imagine the following. You have bought one. And since the event happens rarely, 5 years goes by, and your husband, I say husband because husbands are more likely to have heart attacks and fibrillation than ventricular fibrillation than women. Your husband has developed, suddenly drops to the ground. You don't know where you put it, the defibrillator. You don't know how to use it anymore. And you are losing valuable time, as Steve-O said. Seconds count. Furthermore, consider the following. Your husband may be in the cellar or may be in the bathroom. and nobody's around. What is the value of a defibrillator? Now, if you put a defibrillator in every home in America, America is out of business. It ceases. Yet, this is being promoted now all over the country, and people say it's a great thing. It'll save a life. It won't save lives, and it'll cost a fine penny.
Interesting. So your point, if I can just repeat, is that in some applications, it may make sense as a medical device, but the cost for those devices being all across public spaces may exceed the public benefit. And if it gives people too much kind of false comfort, then it may not be used efficiently in a home environment where time is wasted and people aren't calling 911 or getting EMTs who are much better trained for urgent and critical care.
I totally agree, Steve-O. And from now on, I'm taking you along wherever I lecture.
Well, you are, sir, by the way, to our audience, we have Dr. Lown here, one of the number one medical authorities for your work. And not only that, but we'll talk a little bit about your work in terms of your peace work and involving other doctors. But you lecture all over the world. You've had over 400 research articles published, peer review, medical journals. You've written numerous books, Prescription for Survival, published in 2008, authored The Lost Art of Healing and Practicing the Art While Mastering the Science. Talk a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, that the Lown Institute, and the website is lowninstitute.org, and what is the mission of your work now with the Lown Institute?
If I may ask you a change of the order.
Sure.
Namely, that we discuss the various organizations that I've been involved in, because ultimately that leads to the Lown Institute, which I founded only recently.
Yes, sir. Please, let's start moving back to the other organizations, which are all fascinating. So please describe them as you will.
Well, among the organizations that I was involved in that were founded in this house from which I'm talking, in Newton, the Physicians for Social Responsibility, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, Satellite, Procor, the Ad Hoc Committee to Defend Healthcare, etc. Let me begin with PSI and IPPNW, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. These organizations address the nuclear threat, and they came really in a very difficult time of my life. Here I thought sudden cardiac death is going to consume me for the rest of my life, and I will give to that, and it's a noble cause, and it saves lives. I will not be diverted. And single-mindedness is what is one of the essential elements in the formula of success in science, as it is in business, as it is in every walk of life. So at that time, imagine the late 40s, early 50s, Russia and the United States between them had nuclear bombs equivalent to about 1 million Hiroshimas, or 4 tons of dynamite for every man, woman, and child on Earth. Never before has men possessed such destructive resources to make this planet uninhabitable. Now, and I was not involved with that. And what happened is a doctor at the Brigham, who was a do-gooder, insisted I go listen to a Britisher who just won a Nobel Prize, and he was going to talk about nuclear war. And I says, and I tried to not to go as best as I could because I wasn't interested in this subject. This would have been about 1958 or 59. And I went and listened, and I realized the greatest threat to human life was not sudden cardiac death, but sudden nuclear death. And then I began to give my energies to both of these, which is, I just argued against myself of single-mindedness.
Right.
The doctors proved very effective emissaries to educate and mobilize people against the threat. We were remarkably successful in the United States with PSR because when we came along, you know, duck and cover. You're too young, probably. I haven't seen you, but by your voice, Steve-O, I think you are too young to live through that era.
Well, you're being kind, Dr. Barr. I was born in 1959, and I do remember duck and cover. And in Needham, which is right next to the town you live in presently, Newton, we had what were called Nike sites, which were sites where there were missiles set. And do you think the reason why PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility, were successful was because you weren't political? You didn't have either a military interest or you didn't have a political interest. You were physicians who, based on the Hippocratic Oath, were just looking out for the benefit of humanity and the benefit for life.
I think you hit the button once again, and the public trusted physicians at the time. At the time, a physician, if he or she spoke out on issues outside their field, if a doctor was worried, I better be worried, and we had an enormous resonance with the public. And interestingly enough, the Kennedy administration realized that they were sponsoring underground shelters because there was no place to hide. And underground shelters, as our research shows, was the worst place to be in case of a nuclear war. The example of Dresden, of the bombing of Hamburg, of Tokyo, of the firestorms all over Japan. When a nuclear bomb falls, it sucks out the oxygen, and it sucks it out of shelters. People who were not in shelters still had some chance to survive, but those in shelters all died 100% dead. Well, we ended shelters in America with our articles published in New England Journal of Medicine, because just 50 years, a year ago, that we published those articles, a series of 5-6 articles showing what the consequences are. We also, I had a call from the White House, from Kennedy, President Kennedy, somebody saying the president would like PSR to, so wealth was outstanding in America, and then this has not been told before, that we should put advertisements in newspapers where senators were voting against the test ban treaty, the atmospheric test ban treaty, which he was pushing at the time. And the Kennedy administration, we had no money, but they helped us raise funds.
Wow.
Now the climate change is even more profound a threat than the nuclear ever was. Yet how little it is spoken about.
Wow. And in the next couple of minutes, by the way, we have Dr. Lown, who is the developer of the defibrillator, and he's your list of credentials. We could do a whole show. Recognized with the UNESCO Peace Prize, the Cardinal Medeiros Peace Prize, the Gandhi Peace Prize, 20 honorary degrees. I've been saying for a number of years relative to climate change that much like your work with Physicians for Social Responsibility in terms of nuclear proliferation in the 60s, I believe that was based on science. It was based on math, based on physics, based on just reality. I believe that climate change is very similar. When you look at what's happening to the atmosphere, you look at acidity in the ocean, you look at ocean temperatures and the ecosystem, If you could speak briefly on your thoughts on that, Dr. Lown, I'd be really fascinated to hear. For you to say that you think climate change is a bigger threat, to paraphrase, than the nuclear threat, can you please explain that?
Well, it's a bigger threat because a nuclear threat would not have destroyed all of life. It's inconceivable to me if the Russians let go with their arsenal and we let go with our arsenal, we would make large parts of the world radioactive, but life itself would continue. But climate change, which fundamentally changes the chemistry, and the chemistry is obdurate. It doesn't yield to arguments, to prayer, to whatever. The chemistry of the world. If you reduce oxygen saturation by a few percent, life becomes impossible. And global warming is changing these vital chemical parameters. And those are not theories. The majority of the United Nations Commissioner on Climate came out and said that by 2040, the average coldest day will be hotter than the average hottest day now. Now, the average hottest day now is what, 100 degrees? The coldest day will be more than that. So we are facing a catastrophe of unimagined magnitude. But I'd like to turn away from that to a more pleasant subject, Steve-O, if you'll permit me.
I will. We have just 2 minutes left. And any subject you'd like to talk about, Dr. Lown?
I would like to talk about what we did that led to the Lown Institute.
Please.
Namely, Satellite, Procore, the Ad Hoc Committee to Defend Healthcare, birthed in our home, as I said, in Newton, where Louise and I and my three children, Fred, Anna, and Naomi, spent formative years. We have now lived 54 years, Steve, nearly your lifetime, next to you, where you were born, in Needham.
Right.
Now, Satellite and Procore are some of the most felicitous achievements of my life. The unique and distinct organization. Satellite is incredible, but if we have 2 minutes, I'll skip it.
Well, I think it's fascinating, but you're basically using technology, right? Satellite internet technologies to serve health communication information in developing countries. Is it a technology-based enterprise?
Well, these are technology-based, but have also a social matrix to them. First, that Hart Committee to Defend Healthcare, we claim to achieve a single payer, and we had a 1998 group of five doctors, merely five doctors, and eventually 2,000 joined us, and we had a referendum in 2048% of the voters. Without any money, compared to the powerful lobbies, we succeeded in getting 48% of the vote. That led Mitt Romney, elected governor in 2002, to introduce Romney Care and now Obamacare.
Right.
Now, for the last item, the Lown Institute. Though I'm now a nonagenarian, you know what that is?
In your 90s?
Yes. I've rarely been as excited about a project. Firstly, I think the Lown Institute aims, in the big global sense, to have doctors once again mobilized to be able to bring about fundamental change in healthcare, which is in disarray, and fundamentally base itself on a renaissance view of the world to make profound change in America. So that will be my final big mission, to bring affordable, humane care to the American people. I believe, as you know, as you have quoted, from the Lost Art of Healing, medicine is a calling. At its core, it's a moral enterprise grounded in a covenant of trust between health professionals and patients. The primary mission of the doctor is to heal, to care, to advocate for the sick, and to work for the promotion of everybody's health. And I fundamentally, deeply believe that we must be as though the destiny of the world depended on each of our actions, whether it involves climate, whether it involves health, whether it involves whatever we are compelled by historic possibility. This is the moral imperative of our age. And this is my deepest belief.
Well, Doctor, I couldn't agree more. It's been such a pleasure having you on Tide Smart Talk, News Talk WLAB 1310. One of the first reasons we reached out to you is not only your work in medicine, your work as the developer, inventor of the DC defibrillator, your peace work, but also because you have such a history here in Maine, spending time in Maine as a young person and then graduating University of Maine. Do you have a final message to our listeners here in Maine in terms of your experience and your deep connection to Maine?
Yeah, I think maniacs, I hope nobody objects to that. That is an endearing term. Get involved with climate. Get involved in helping us bring about a healthcare system that is practiced really in many parts of the developing world and bring about dignity to life that we all deserve in our struggle against poverty and our struggle against the so many social injustices that prevail today.
Well, I agree, and clearly you have given your life's work to helping people as a doctor, as somebody, as an inventor, as a speaker, as somebody who's been a peace activist, and now somebody who cares about the climate and the environment. I have to tell you, in the few years of doing the show, I think this interview has been the most rewarding so far, not only because of your connection to Maine, but the scale and scope of your work and the number of millions and millions of lives that you have directly impacted. It has been a profound pleasure and honor for me, and I hope that we have the opportunity to talk again, Dr. Lin.
Thank you so much, Steve-O.
And anyone interested in more information, please go to www.lowninstitute.org. Lown, of course, is L-O-W-N. Also on Twitter at Lown Convo Health. And this has been an incredible pleasure, incredible honor. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Thank you.